Welcome to the this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, today is Tuesday, February 5th, 2008. It's about 1:35 in the afternoon here in the Belch Room, and members present are Senators Davis, myself, Senator Ellis, and Senator Stevens, who's looking very sharp today, the best-dressed man in the Alaska State Senate. So I guess I thought it was a work session again today, and dressed in my jeans. So. Thank you all for being here today. I know there are folks from the State Department of Labor, members of the public, staff. Thank you all for being with us on a Saturday. That is the nature of the beast in a 90-day session. We intend to crack the whip and get through this in the voter-allowed period of time. So thank you for hanging with us today. Our game plan for committee action or committee work today is first to hear the initial public testimony or presentation and public testimony on House Joint Resolution Number 25 by Speaker John Harris, supporting the right to form labor unions. We're going to hear that. Of course, it's our habit in this committee to hold over legislation from the first hearing to give it due consideration. So I understand we'll be having that presentation first, and then we'll be taking up further consideration on Senate Bill 120, the unemployment compensation bill. So with that, I believe Speaker Harris has sent his representative, Mr. Pete Fellman. Mr. Fellman, if you could join us at the table. And HJR 25 is the item before us. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Ellis, members of the committee. My name is Pete Fellman. I'm staff for Representative John Harris. HJR 25 is not a piece of legislation that I carried through the House. It's rather new to me. And as I've had the opportunity to research this piece of legislation in the last week or so, I've read the Employees Free Choice Act of 2007. I've read lots of information about corporations and how they function and how they deal with unions. I've read a lot of information about unions and forming unions, and it's been very educational to me. There's no doubt this is a very hotly debated and passionate subject when it comes to unions and labor and with corporations. You know, I've heard an awful lot. When I first started doing the research on this, there was a lot of sound bites out there. You know, this piece of legislation takes away your right to vote privately, or this piece of legislation is supported by the Communist Party, and so on. There's all this stuff that has been floating around the building, just out of the passion that revolves around this. And really, through my research, I've come to the conclusion that, to some degree, maybe both sides are right. That on one hand, it's easy to show that corporations have intimidated, harassed, threatened employees who have considered to join unions. There's examples of that going on today, and I won't get into company names and so on. It's not necessary. On the other hand, it's easy to show that past unions, to some level, have engaged in some of the same tactics. You know, it's there. It's history. And then on the other hand, there's good examples of honorable companies that pay fair wages, and they treat their benefits fairly, give them good time, and give them good and give them good wages. And there are also good examples of unions that have negotiated good, fair contracts, you know, for people that needed representation. Members of the committee, you know, if we lived in a perfect world, you know, and people gave a fair day's work and received a fair wage for that work, we wouldn't have this debate. Our concern, on the other hand, is for the working people. You know, some of those folks may not have the ability, the capability, or the tools at hand to make sure that they can support themselves and that they will have support from their employer or their employee relations. Just as a matter of fact, if I may inject a little personal experience here, as some of you know, I've been working in the building for 10 years, and 4 years ago, my son Uriah was a page on the House floor, and he had the opportunity through the process to make a connection with the Iron Workers Union. Now, he wasn't an academic. He was a boy raised on a farm, which I am also a small business owner. And, you know, the Iron Workers Union took him to school. They trained him. They taught him a trade. They do drug testing in order to keep make sure that the workforce is clean, you know, and that they're hardworking individuals. They teach them a good trade. These people are building America, there's no doubt. And I have all the admiration in the world for what the labor unions do for people. Not everybody has a college degree, but we have a serious shortage in this world of electricians and iron workers and pipe fitters and carpenters and so on, and that's what this union, these union individuals do. On the other hand, again, I'm a small business owner. You know, I've run several small businesses, and I have never been in a situation where I've had anybody come to me and with a concern, and then because I didn't address their concern, threaten me with union activity. You know, I try to treat my employees respectfully, and I try to give them good wages and so on. And on the other hand, if I had to go through that process, it would be a very serious and stressful situation for my small business. So in order to speak further on it, we have Vince Bellatrami online with the FL-CIO. He can explain to you more about the process. I understand the process the best that I could in a few short days that I've worked on it, but I think if you would like to ask questions of him, I believe he's online at the Anchorage LIO.
Okay. Mr. Feldman, thank you for being with us. I appreciate your personal perspective on the legislation, but you are strongly in support of the resolution for your boss. Is that your point?
Yes, I do support the resolution for my boss.
Okay. Because it sounded like you were equally on both sides of the issue. But
it has been a real educational experience, Senator.
Okay. But so you have a perspective on both sides of the issue, union and non-union, but you are supporting the resolution.
I do support the resolution.
Okay. That's a good thing for a staffer to do when they're carrying the Speaker of the House's important legislation. Mr. Feldman, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it. Mr. Vince Bellatrami is the first person signed up to testify, and if anybody else would like to give public testimony today, this is your opportunity, so please sign up. Mr. Bellatrami, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me, Senator Ellis?
Loud and clear, if you can give your name and affiliation for the record, and then go ahead.
Sure. Vince Bellatrami, president of the Alaska AFL-CIO. And I was basically asked to kind of give any technical clarification on what this bill seeks to do. As you know, it's a U.S. House bill. It went through the House. It had a majority in the U.S. Senate support it, but President Bush had threatened to veto it if it went through. So far, they haven't moved it through the U.S. Senate. But the reason that the bill was introduced in the first place was to try and fix what's largely perceived to be a broken process through the National Labor Relations Board in their elections. And there's a lot of misconceptions about what it is that the bill would do. It doesn't take away the right for a group of people to have an election if they so choose, a secret ballot election. But on the other hand, I'd kind of like to explain it. It's not the National Labor Relations Board process is not like any other election process that you or I go through when we go to the polls and go behind a booth and check a box for a candidate or a bond or whatever. There's never the same kind of coercion or negative outcome associated with you casting that ballot. Whereas in the union elections, the way it works, when people decide to sign an authorization card and put into motion the process to have an election, that all the election does is, if it's successful, gives the employees the right to have a labor organization sit down and negotiate with them to get a contract. And that process, once the petition has been filed and there's a campaign ongoing, ordinarily there's a lot of stuff that happens, a lot of discrimination and firing and intimidation that goes on in the process today, very unlike what happened originally when the National Labor Relations Act was first put into place in 1935. The process is kind of eroded. So the Employee Free Choice Act is an attempt to try to put a little more control back into the hands of the employees for whom that act was actually created. And to explain on a technical aspect, I guess, and I don't want to take too much time, but right now, under the NLRB procedure, if more than 30% of employees in a particular company decide they want representation, they sign an authorization card, and that is enough to get the process going and file a petition with the NLRB to then go through that whole procedure. Now, in essence, what the Employee Free Choice Act would do is if more than 50% of people at an employer decide to sign those authorization cards, that in effect is the election. And then they would, upon verification, they would then sit down with the employer. The employer would be committed to bargaining with them at that time. And the Employee Free Choice Act makes sure that they would basically be free from the same types of things that go on today in the typical election process for a union. And it would also require them to get to an agreement, whereas these days, a lot of times, if the group is successful in going through that campaign and they still have a majority of people vote in the election, oftentimes they'll go years without ever actually getting to a contract, a lot of stall tactics and stuff like that. But if this were to go through, it would require the employer and the union to come to an agreement. And if they couldn't, within a set up amount of time, and I believe it's 120 days, if they don't come to an agreement, it would then go to mediation and arbitration, and there would actually be an agreement. So it's to kind of expedite the process. But one thing that I'd like to make clear is if, in fact, there are still 30% of the people at any property that wanted to make sure that they still had that secret ballot election available, it still will be available for this bill. There's a lot of other kind of technicalities about it, and I don't want to weigh down all the testimony, but I would certainly be happy to answer any questions if you had any. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to weigh in.
Okay, Mr. Beltrami, thank you for being with us. I guess you were trying to get to Juneau but didn't make it?
Yeah, I would have ended up in Ketchikan.
Oh, okay.
I tried to get there this morning, but the weather storms and whatnot said that they canceled the flight and it just went directly to Ketchikan. So okay.
We've all done the Southeast Shuffle, and I guess there's serious weather all over the state, so stay warm up there. Any questions or comments for Mr. Beltrami? Senator Stevens?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Beltrami, I think I understand the secret ballot. That makes a lot of sense to me. That's democracy, and no one can force you to vote one way or the other in a secret ballot, and you make your you vote and nobody knows how you voted, and that's to me perfect. I understand your point that there may have been instances where that led to discrimination and firing, and that's a horrible thing, and we need to take that into account. But tell me how what you're talking about is an improvement with these authorization cards, which you need to explain to me because I don't really understand it, but it sounds to me like you would bring me, for example, Ms. Beltrami, you bring me an authorization card and ask me if I want to sign it, and I have to decide in front of you whether I want to sign it. That's not a secret ballot. That's taking away my rights as an individual. And maybe I misunderstand that. Please explain it to me.
Well, sir, certainly I'll do my best, but in the process today, if people want to have an election to the NLRB, they still have to collect those authorization cards. So at least 30% of the people go on record one way or the other. And ordinarily, the truth is, and I'm a former union organizer, and I never would actually file a petition unless I had more like 60 or 70% of the authorization cards. And that is, in fact, what I did when I filed several election petitions. So it's the same process. People that sign those cards do so willingly. The difference is that would constitute the election. And while I appreciate what you said about the secret ballot election, as I kind of stated earlier, this is unlike no other secret ballot election process. As I said, if you go to the polls, you are not subject to any kind of intimidation, harassment, or firing, which goes on today in almost every single election process under the National Labor Relations Board today. And that the card check process that the Employee Free Choice Act would allow is actually one that a lot of employers historically have lived up to voluntarily. Singular Wireless is the biggest example of a large company recently. That's their That is their policy. If a majority of employees at any singular wireless property sign these authorization cards, Singular recognizes that and goes right immediately to the bargaining process. So I don't think it does away. And again, if 30% of the people in the group would like to have, even if those authorization cards have been collected, more than 50%, if there's 30% of that employer property of the employees that want to have a secret ballot election, this doesn't change that. They still get to have that as an option.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't think my question was really answered. I mean, you are a union organizer. You come to me. I'm an employee. And you bring this card to me and ask me to sign it. Is that true? And I either sign it or not in front of you. And so we have lost the element of secrecy of a ballot, which seems to me to be a pretty sacred issue. Am I missing the point here? Maybe you can explain it more.
Well, I mean, the authorization cards in any process, in any NLRB process, they're still signed by the employees and handed but voluntarily and given to the union organizer. I mean, whether it's in this process, the Employee Free Choice Act process, that element is unchanged from the way the National Labor Relations Act has been since 1935.
Thank you both, gentlemen. I'd like to note for the record at this time that Senator Joe Thomas has joined the committee along with Representative Harry Crawford. Thank you guys for being with us this weekend. Anything further for Mr. Beltrami? If not, Vince, if you want to stay on the line there, we're going to see if there are other folks who would like to testify. I would note also that this resolution, which will not move today but will be back before us in the future, also has further referrals in the Senate to State Affairs and to Senate Finance. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on HJR 25? This is the opportunity for public testimony. Dana, is anyone else signed up? Okay. Okay, Tom Bryce and then Denny DeWitt. Mr. Bryce, if you give your name and affiliation for the record, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very briefly, my name is Tom Bryce. I represent the Alaska District Council of Labor's, representing roughly 7,000 employees throughout the state of Alaska in both the public and the private industry. We're just very briefly, Mr. Chair, I'd like to be on record in support of HJR 25. One thing that seems to be forgotten quite often is that people view the union as this outside entity coming in. It's not. It's the employees themselves. It's simply signing a petition saying you want a contract. And this is, I think, the point that Mr. Beltrami was trying to make. With that, I'll close my testimony and thank you for your support for this resolution.
Mr. Bryce, thanks for being here. Is your understanding the same as Mr. Beltrami's that the understanding Senator Stevens' point about a breach of confidentiality, and Mr. Beltrami made the point that already occurs with the presentation of the signature. The signatures are already disclosed. So the resolution, if it were to leverage passage of federal legislation that's proposed would anything change in relation to revealing people's identities for?
I think the point that Mr. Beltrami was trying to make, and I think another way of putting it is, once those cards are signed and presented to the Labor Relations Board, that point in time the employer has an idea of who signed that. Then there is an intermittent point in time in which that employer can come in and try to get those cards thrown out or talk with those employees in closed-door sessions, what have you, using certain tactics, asking those cards to be revoked or to influence that employee's voice. I've seen that actually in the organizing efforts up in Fairbanks back in 1992-93 with the Fred Meyers workers, where they had presented cards, at which point in time the employer came in, identified those individuals, and said, boom, you know, here's the way it's going to go. Some of the stories were you're going to either be fired or you're going to kick back your card. Additionally, just here recently in Juneau, rumors were when Walmart was hiring before they opened, they had closed door meetings where employees were required to come in, sit down, and listen to 3 hours, 4 hours of anti-union propaganda. If you did not attend that, you were paid for it, but if you did not attend it, then you weren't hired. Those types of tactics occur. I think EFCA addresses the point by minimizing that length of time the employer can go in and try to influence an employee's decision. Mm-hmm. Very simply, signing that petition, signing your card should serve as that vote.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Tom, you need to help me understand this. I understand a secret election, mm-hmm. and you can ask for that, right? And no one knows how you vote. No one can force you to vote one way or the other. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with a secret election?
The point is it no longer becomes secret after that point, once those names are revealed who have signed that card. All of a sudden, the employer recognizes...
Isn't there an election process, and then there's a card process, or am I misunderstanding?
There's a card process, then an election process. The point is that once that card process has played out, that employer has the ability to access those employees and to unduly influence them, be it intimidation, be it coercion, what have you. And those things still do occur. I mean, and Mr. Beltrami could probably answer or give a broader range of instances where that's occurred. The point I think we're trying to get at with EFCA is that you come up with over half of the membership of the employees that want to join a union, that they've made their voice heard. And that should serve as the election. And then you should be able to go straight to negotiations at that point in time without allowing the employer to come in and then attempt undue influence.
Okay. So we're trying to gain a better understanding here of the process and confidentiality. And Mr. Beltrami, do you have a quick comment on that specific point?
Yeah, Senator, if I may, the one thing I might make a little more clear for Senator Stevens, in the collection of the cards, initially in the authorization cards, it is not known. The employees, you know, they give freely. They will or will not sign them. When they give those to a union organizer, those go to the National Labor Relations Board, where they are then sealed, and it's not known. So in any event of, say, a 100 employee group, if 60, 70 people signed those cards willingly and they were turned into the board, the names of the people who signed those cards is not revealed. But the company provides a list, say, of those 100 employees to confirm that they were, in fact, employees that are within the proper bargaining unit. And then they go through that election process in today's world. But now that would be considered the election. And it's only known voluntarily if that employee wants to hand the union organizer that card, if that clarifies it a little better.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Beltrami. I would note also that Mr. Feldman has provided us a piece of paper here that's in committee members' packets about the National Labor Relations Board election process now compared to what's proposed under the federal legislation, which this resolution promotes. So that gives some information. Mr. Feldman, there's no identifying marks on here. It's better if you put the source of the material for us, and we'll collect these back up and put provided by Speaker Harris on the so we'll know where the information came from. But it's helpful for members to have. Okay, Mr. Bryce, thanks very much for being with us. Mr. DeWitt.
Good afternoon. I'm Denny DeWitt. I'm the Alaska Director for the National Federation of Independent Business, Alaska. I, like you, have not read the full context of H.R. 800. Although the one issue that has been called to our attention is the issue of the process for election that's being changed, which is one that we have great problems with. I've tried to get someone from our national office to get available, and if we're having testimony again next Saturday, I hope that I can get someone who can fully discuss the federal legislation, which does go beyond the one point that I'm going to raise today. Our concern with moving away from the secret ballot, Senator Stevens has been hitting on our concern. Currently, 30% or more sign the card, then you can have a secret ballot election. Many folks, certainly when presented with a card in front of them and a little pressure to sign the card, may or may not sign the card. Folks may feel that their other colleagues may, you know, pressure them to sign the card. But when they have a secret ballot option, they can truly reflect how they believe an issue ought to go. And that's why we have secret ballots in all our traditional elections. What this would do, as I understand it generally, is if you have 50% or more than 50% sign the card, that becomes the election. The alternative then is for, as I understand it, 30% of the folks can then come back and petition to have an election. But the box you put somebody in at that point in time is if 51% of the folks sign the cards, then obviously, and it's moving forward, obviously if you're willing to sign a card saying I want an election, you've already told people I'm going to vote against it. That's why you would want an election. So you put people in a box of the only way they can get a secret ballot election is by signing a card that says, I don't agree with what's going on. I want a secret election. And that's another bit of pressure that we think is very inappropriate. We heard testimony that Singular buys on and will negotiate if they see 51% of their employees in a unit signing cards. And we think that's appropriate. We don't need a law change for employers to act in that fashion. We are concerned, very concerned about the election process, how it works. We're also concerned that we're buying into a notion that we as Alaskans, through this resolution process, ought to buy into and support a bill that's got a lot of stuff in it that we've not looked at here through this committee, through the House, in terms of all the issues that are in it. And we're suggesting that that's probably, in terms of supporting specific legislation, pretty poor public policy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. DeWitt. Are there questions or comments for the presenter? If not, thanks for being here. That's Representative Crawford, are you standing up to come forward, please? I didn't have you signed up, but we're happy to accommodate any comments you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
I didn't realize that I was going to need to comment on this, but having worked as a union organizer in the construction trades, practically what happened, numerous times I was able to go out and go to work on non-union jobs and get 75 to 80% of the people to sign cards. But what would happen is that the NLRB vote was delayed to the point, two things that they would do. They'd use that time to work on people and find out how they felt about whether they should unionize or not unionize. They would lay off or fire people that were union supporters. Also, they would delay until the end of the job was over with before the election was actually called. I was never able in the years that I worked as a union organizer to actually get to the point of having an election. So numerous times I got as much as 75% of the people on a job. One time I actually had a unanimous, but I couldn't get the people to voluntarily recognize the iron workers as the bargaining agent because they wanted to wait for the NLRB election, and we never got that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Crawford. Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Sharon. And I apologize for
not at all,
these questions.
Go right ahead.
It's an area that is not really my experience. So, Harry, I understand what you're saying. When someone someone's rights are abused, is there no other recourse if someone is fired because they were in favor of organizing a union? Isn't there some legal recourse, or is the only thing to change the law as you are suggesting here?
There were times when, like when I got fired out at the airport by the company that was doing an expansion on FedEx. I actually got a few weeks back pay about 3 years down the road. But of all those people that were actually laid off or fired at that time because they sided with the union, they never got anything because they weren't able to make the case that the company wasn't just reorganizing their workforce. And they, I mean, I had actual proof, and that's the reason why we got back pay in my case, but most of those people could not make the case that that was the actual reason why they got laid off the next morning. When the day before they thought they had months more of work.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Crawford. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? This is the public hearing on HDR 25. No. Senator Thomas, please come forward.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Joe Thomas. Senator Thomas. Testifying as a private citizen here today. Anyhow, I just didn't come prepared to testify, but I thought after listening to some of the testimony I would attempt to maybe clarify a couple of things that were mentioned. Senator Stevens, you asked regarding the signing of the cards and the secrecy of those. It's not necessarily that somebody hands you a card and you have to fill it out and turn it back. Most people take them and think about it. They want to discuss it with their significant other, their wife, their husband, or whatever, to see what they potentially think about it, or maybe somebody else. The thing that I found in mostly is somewhat was alluded to by both Mr. Beltrami and Representative Crawford, is that it's the time frame that takes. And actually, the only way for somebody to ensure, if you were to sign a collective bargaining card, some people obviously will know that some did. I mean, some people speak freely about it. Usually there is a fair amount of intimidation. The companies come back and say that you will be required to go on strike. They're going to take your dues money. You have no rights left any longer. The union makes all those decisions. Those things are not accurate. Those are things that are required. You cannot put people on strike without strike votes. You hear about them. We hear about it particularly in state government because you hear the petition or the threat, however one wants to look at it, of the various employee bargaining units going to be considering a strike vote or something like that, just part of the process of negotiations. But what we found repeatedly, and we spent 10 years negotiating with Neighbors Drilling at Prudhoe Bay to try and get a contract. Took a long time to even get the election, finally did. But what we found in that particular situation, as well as most others, is that once there is a petition for an election and it is the time is set, that between that point in time there's a lot of information, disinformation, however you might want to look at it, by the company and people being fired, and there is a process obviously that was related to you to go to the NLRB and claim that there was an unfair termination of somebody. So that starts winding its way through it. So that's a long process too, like most legal processes. And it's to the company's advantage to create that situation because that puts fear in people's mind. And what that then does is the only way for somebody to appear to the company not to be in favor of unionization is to not vote, is to not show up on the day of the secret ballot election. That is clear to them because you sign in when you vote, just like you do in a regular election. The way that you cause the company to know that you are not in favor of the union, even though you may have been at the beginning of the process, is to not show up and vote. So they find a great disparity in the number of people that filled out cards and the number of people that ultimately vote in the elections, unless it is just such an egregious working conditions that people don't care what takes place during in the meantime and they sign. But that's what we found. People were afraid to even be involved. No one wanted to even volunteer to be on the negotiations committee because there was concern that they would sooner or later find a way of getting rid of that person, whether they showed up for work a time or two late or whatever the process might be. So I just wanted to make sure that people understood, number one, that you don't have to fill out that card in anybody's presence. You turn it back into somebody, and you could actually, if you wanted to, you could probably mail it to the National Labor Relations Board if you wanted to retain the secrecy of it. So,
okay.
Anyhow, that's just my 2 cents worth on it. So.
Senator, thank you for your 2 cents. You're always welcome here.
Okay, thanks.
Is there anyone further on HDR 25? Seeing and hearing no one. Is there anyone online? Okay. Thanks for the public testimony today. I'll close public testimony at this time. We're going to hold over HJR 25. Mr. Feldman, thanks for being with us. And we're going to hold it over for further consideration.
I want to speak to it before you close out on it.
Okay. Senator Davis.
First of all, I want to say that I'm in support of the resolution that we have here. I was looking at it, and I see on the further resolves where you're sending it, and you don't send it to the Speaker of the House. I wondered if that was an oversight or was there a reason why that particular person was not included. Would the Speaker, sponsor speak to that? And my next question of the sponsor is to tell me where this piece of legislation is. Has it passed the House of the Senate yet? And in what stage is it compared to what you are asking on your resolution?
Through the chair, Senator Davis, the current legislation is H.R. 800, and it did pass the House in Congress. It has not passed the Senate. The other question, as far as the resolution goes and the way it was put together, I was not involved in that, and so I'll have to check to see. I will definitely make a note of that and get back to you on why we didn't refer to the Speaker of the House. And so I will try to clarify that.
You said it had passed the House?
It passed the House.
That could be the reason why it's not on there, because it has the President of the Senate on there, and it has not passed the Senate, right?
That's correct.
So that could be the reason.
Okay.
But please check on
that. I will, and I will get back to you. Thank you.
Okay. Good point, Senator Davis. Mr. Feldman, thank you again. Oh, Senator Stevens.
One question. Someone in the testimony brought up that this is a complicated bill. Have you read the bill, Employees Free Choice Act?
Senator Stevens, I have printed that off. I have it in my office. I did a line-by-line comparison, and it involves a lot of history. It's a law that is in existence, and I have gone through and I have tried to do that comparison. I can give you a copy of that if you would like. The changes that we have discussed here, I think that's the way it's working. That, you know, it doesn't remove that 30%, you know, and I think it's the way it's been represented today, I think is accurate. It's just a very big piece of legislation that the law itself, as it's in current statute.
And follow, you're not concerned there's something other than what we're dealing with on this one sheet of paper from Representative Harris. There's something else in there that we're missing the point on or we're not understanding.
In my understanding, I don't believe so.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks again, Mr. Feldman. We'll look forward to further work with you on this resolution.
Thank you.
Okay, let's set that one aside. And as we're getting our folders prepared for Senate Bill 120, I do want to remind the committee that we're going to take or have back before us the STEP extension bill this coming week. And I've asked committee members to look that over, and we've had the first hearing. We'll have it back before us this week. We need committee members to think about the time frame that we can muster for the extension of the STEP bill. The Palin administration and the sponsor, Representative John Coghill, had proposed making it a permanent statute, a permanent program in statute. And folks in the House didn't want to make it permanent, but had an extension date. I've proposed an extension date of 2018 in the CS that's before the committee, for consideration, and we need to figure out our comfort level in the Senate for an extension period of time for STEP. The 2018 sort of comports with some of the things Department of Labor or the commissioner had represented to me about, you know, gearing up, an optimistic, I guess, gearing up for the a gas pipeline and the training, workforce training needs for a gas pipeline. So I threw that number out there. It makes sense to me in terms of workforce training in the state, but we need to come to grips in the committee with a date for extending STEP. And so we'll be confronting that on Tuesday or Thursday. We'll let you all know. Okay, let's turn now to Senate Bill 120 under bills previously heard. This is the Unemployment Compensation Benefits Bill. The legislation goes on to the Finance Committee, and we do need to come to a decision point here rather soon. Mr. Owen, if you could join us at the table. We do have Department of Labor folks with us as resource people today. There was a previous committee substitute here in the committee, and I've been working with folks and trying to take in all kinds of comments from the work session on Saturday. Just to remind folks who are listening and members of the committee, this we've had almost an entire year of stakeholder meetings over the interim, working with business groups, labor groups, other interested parties on the UI issue because we're way behind the curve here. And Governor Palin recently announced some very some stunningly good news for employers about the rates over the next few years. So it's a really good time to make a modest increase in benefits, in my view. That's what we've been working toward, hearing all the issues involved. Last Saturday, we had a work session of the committee. We had a full house here with labor folks and business representatives. It was a very good work session, hearing different concerns from the business community in particular. So there's been a CS out there, and I'm bringing a revised CS or a new CS before the committee, and I'm going to have Mr. Owen go through some of those changes. Then we're going to hear from Department of Labor about those changes, and I'll comment as we go through. Mr. Owen, welcome, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dana Owen. I am staff to Senator Ellis and to this committee. You may recall in the discussion that we had last Saturday during our work session, we were attempting in that CS to balance some equities. We had, on the one hand, a unemployment insurance benefits situation which had not been changed in 10 years, and it was widely regarded that we needed to raise those benefits. The arguments that we had heard about the CS and the bill was that there didn't seem to be a recognition in the bill that from the employer's point of view, the system, the unemployment insurance benefit system as it was structured, was costly and was more costly than it needed to be. So we entertained quite a number of suggestions from employer groups about how we could possibly bring the costs down to employers. In that CS that we were discussing on Saturday, we did that in two ways. We attempted to shift, in that CS we would shift approximately $2 million of tax liability from employers over to employees. We found an additional cost savings to employers of approximately $5.4 million by denying benefits to employees who had been fired for misconduct. Subsequent to that meeting, and during that meeting, we heard vigorous testimony from labor folks that, in fact, this would create a greater hardship on, that is to say, the denying of benefits to people would create a great hardship. And the fear was that that provision would be an incentive for employers to abuse that system, and we would have people fired for misconduct who, in fact, were not fired for misconduct. However, still wanting to retain that benefit to employers of approximately $7.4 million reduction in their tax burden, we looked for a different way to accomplish that. We heard on Saturday that there may be a couple of different ways to do that.
One of the ways that we looked at was to raise the minimum benefits that are the minimum wage in the base period that it takes to qualify for benefits. In this CS, we have done away with the provision to deny benefits to those fired for misconduct. And instead, we have retained the provision of shifting the tax burden from employers over into employees by amending the percentage. Currently, in current law, the percentage is 80% paid by employers and 20% paid by employees. In this CS, we have changed that to 73% paid for by employers and 27% paid for by employees. My understanding is that that shifts approximately $7 million in aggregate off of the employers and over onto the employees. We reach another $800,000 or $0.8 million savings to the employer and by raising the minimum amount necessary to qualify from $1,000 to $2,500. It had been suggested that we could look at various numbers. We found that this was a number that seemed to be a little bit more comfortable with. So this CS contains that provision. So again, just to look at that aggregate savings, the CS that we looked at last time was $7.4 million. In this CS, it's $7.8 million. And I believe we have people from the Department of Labor who can verify those numbers for me.
Okay. Mr. Owen, first a question from Senator Stevens, and then I want to go through some of this with you.
Sure.
Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I was following you right along every step of the way, except when we got to the issue of the denying, well, it's not defining denying benefits, it's... Let me back up here. Could you explain the issue about raising the minimum from 1,000 to 2,500? Could you start at the beginning and make sure I understand what you're talking about?
In current law, Mr. Chairman, in current law, you have to have a minimum of have earned a minimum of $1,000 in, as I think, in each of two quarters. Is that
two quarters?
I believe that's correct. That's the minimum qualifying amount. If you make less than that, you don't qualify for benefits.
Okay.
We have raised that minimum to $2,500 in this CS.
Thank you.
Okay.
I understand that now.
Okay.
And that $1,000
being clear.
That $1,000 was established in statute a long time ago at the work session. We asked why hasn't that been updated? Some of the business groups wanted to raise it, you know, very much higher. And the 25 going from the 1,000 to the 2,500 seems reasonable to me personally to update that in the statute. We haven't had any huge objection. It's a $800,000 savings to employers. It seemed like it was past time to update that figure without harming anyone, really in particular. The $1,000 is an outmoded figure. So we have made a very aggressive and sincere search here to listen to everybody and find the most savings we could in the system. So back to the main issues here, Mr. Owen, were the dismissal provision, then the money provisions, the relative balance between employers and employees on the rate, and then the minimum earnings. Back on the dismissal. You know, there was that became a non-starter, big pushback from folks that it really would, that no one in the state would ever be really laid off again. People would be dismissed for conduct, misconduct, and even though there is an appeals process, it's you know, a hassle and onerous and time-consuming and expensive for some of the parties. So that just seemed to be something where we weren't going to get anywhere with this legislation if that were part of it. So we've tried to make up for that with the impact on employers. Like we said, do we have the charts available for folks that show the impact on the employers?
I'm afraid we don't. The department's here to discuss those. They weren't able to produce new charts to update them.
Okay. Yeah. Well, they we'll get into that later, but basically they show that this is a really good environment in which to make this change, that over the next few years. It's a big reduction in the cost to employers, and we're going deeper. We're offsetting a lot of the impact to employers if this bill were to pass. There's also the issue of the appeals resulting from the change of dismissal translating to some increased workload for the Department of Labor. So I just made the decision to propose to the committee not fighting that controversial battle, which I think is a no-win situation that stymies the bill, and try and give more significant benefit to the employers without without significantly impacting the employee. So we're originally, you know, the system's 80-20, employer to employee. The first committee substitute went from 78 to 22. But we've taken away this other change in the system that was worth $5.4 million. So we've gone to 73% for the employer, 27% for the employee. I don't know how I could get any more fair or impactful in a positive way to the employees. That's pretty much that, I think, is the limit that we can go to help folks out. And so it all adds up to a $7.8 million reduction beyond the already structural reduction to employers in the state of Alaska. Is that accurate?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, I'm just sort of talking through this so you can correct me if I'm off the mark.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I can, I'd like to add one more thing that I meant to mention earlier, is that while we haven't raised that benefit, that minimum amount to qualify for benefits in many years, I'm told that some states actually raise that as a have done it many times. They either have an escalator clause in their law that does it automatically, but they routinely do it, and we have not done that. And if I'm not mistaken, last Saturday we heard that it hasn't been raised since the 1970s, I believe. But the Department of Labor can clarify that, I think.
And remind us from there was really good information at the work session, and part of it was where if this bill were to become law, we would be a little bit below the middle of the pack among the states in overall weekly benefit, the average weekly benefit.
Mr. Chairman, I think I heard testimony, well, or at least discussion, that we would be somewhere in the middle of the pack.
Okay. So in terms of increase in benefits, this isn't, we're not going for the Cadillac, it's the Ford Taurus in terms of, that was my joke from last Saturday, but I still got a chuckle, so I'm going to keep using it. Any other questions at this point? Let's have the labor folks, whoever Paula wants to send forward, for some technical information. Ms. Rivera, thank you for all your time and effort on this issue. I do promise you at some point this committee will make a decision, and you'll get to appear before other committees.
For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. I'm Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Labor. I'm also the Legislative Liaison to the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. We have lots of folks here from the Department of Labor to handle tax questions, tax questions, benefit questions. So I'm not sure what questions you want to answer first or who do you want to answer. If you want tax questions, I can bring up Mr. Wilson from RNA, who's been before this committee quite a few times in the last few years on this bill, if that's where you want to go first.
That's where I'd like to go. So, Jim, if you could join Paula there at the table.
I think I've gotten older as this bill keeps.
I think so. Mr. Wilson, thank you for being with us on the second Saturday that you've given to the committee. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you could make some comments then about the, you know, we're at 80-20. The old CS that we were working on was 78-22, split between the employer and the employees. And now we're proposing in the latest version, after the work sessions, to go from 73% for the employer, 27% for the employee, trying to save money for employers in this system without harming anyone's interest significantly. Can you just talk us through that?
To begin with, for the record, my name is James Wilson. I'm with the Alaska Department of Labor. I'm in the Research and Analysis section, and I serve as the Unemployment Insurance Actuary. And I developed a lot of the figures that have been put out to help explain the impact of the bill. So I can go over those.
Okay. And if, and when you do as well, if you can talk about, you know, Governor Palin made her announcement about what's going on with the overall system, this cost savings in what the employers pay that are, is already going to happen structurally within the system. And then this is additional savings beyond that. So can you put it all sort of into context for what people are dealing with? Okay. I know business is still struggling to pay the bills, but there's really good news here with the structural, what's happening with the system, and then what we're proposing in this bill. If you can put that into context for us, okay. I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, in the last over the last few years, Alaska has been enjoying lower than average tax rates, and in the last 3 years, they've come down significantly. For 2008, the governor made an announcement when those tax rates came out. We found that they were the lowest employer tax rates in 30 years of the program. So we're in a period of time now where unemployment is at low levels, the cost of the program is at very low levels, and so far we see that trend continuing where benefit pay outlays are still declining somewhat, so the cost of the program is remaining low even right now as we're just past the peak of our yearly claims experience. The bill that we had before us, the attempt is to increase the maximum benefit amount. There's a schedule in statute which qualifies workers for a benefit as wages go up in $250 increments. There's a $2 increase in weekly benefit amount. And what the bill does is add additional steps on to the top of the schedule. The last benefit increase was in 1997, and at that time there was a modest increase in benefits, and it's been 10 years since that time, so the bill attempts to bring us up to where we need to be. We've seen that in the distribution of states as far as their ability to replace percentage of wages for unemployed workers, that Alaska has fallen further down the ranking over the years. And that was one of the concerns of the sponsors of the bill, and this has been addressed by this committee a number of times, is that we're now pretty much at the bottom of the list. And the intent of the bill with improving the benefit payment would move us up more toward being in the center as compared with other states. When we looked at the bill, we found that with the proposal to increase the benefit maximum to 370, it would increase the cost per worker for the average employer would go up from $470 to $548, and it would take a number of years for that cost to work its way into the financing system. But by 2013, the full cost would be realized, and we estimated that that would be the movement, is the increase from 470 to 548 as a result of that WBA increase. We also looked at a number of different issues. You talked about the disqualification issue, and we looked at the savings there. And in the new committee substitute, that is determined to be pretty controversial, so that's been dropped. We talked about a change in tax share. Right now, under law, employers pay 80% of the total tax burden, and employees 20%, and there was a look at shifting that by 2% to make the employer portion 78 and make the employee portion 22, and we saw that there was about a $2 million shift which created some savings for the employer. With the proposal that you have here, shifting from 73% for the employer and 27% to the employee. Mr. Owen noted that that was about a $7 million shift in tax there. And that shift basically drops the per worker cost for the employer down significantly. Somewhere in the realm of $50. So there's a significant savings there. With the proposal to raise the minimum qualifying wage up from $1,000, and it was noted that that $1,000 is a very old figure that's been in the system since the 1970s, and going up to $2,500 is a modest increase in that mm-hmm. starting point, and that would result in approximately $800,000 in savings. And I haven't run that number, but I'm thinking that that would translate into an additional savings to the employer per worker, perhaps about $5, another $5 in savings there.
Okay. So. Mr. Wilson, on that point, Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, on that point, I'm sure you can tell us, Mr. Wilson, how many Alaskan employees did not reach that $1,000 minimum. It'd be interesting to know, but also interesting to know how many will not reach the $2,500 minimum. What we're talking about, I assume, would be seasonal employees, maybe students, that sort of thing. So can you give me those figures? Do you have those estimates on how many did not reach the $1,000 minimum in the past and how many will not reach the $2,500 minimum in the future?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senator Stevens. We looked at that, and based on the claimant population, we saw that there are approximately 1,466 claimants who were between the 1,000 and the 2,500 point.
I see. Thank you.
And I don't have a number as to the number of people who weren't able to even make the 1,000. So.
Thank you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The employee part.
Okay.
And Paula, you guys are going to get us the updated charts then with this proposed benefit to employers. The chart will look even better than that really great chart that you had last week.
For the
by quite a few millions of dollars.
For the record, Senator Ellis, we weren't able to get everyone together, get the charts done, and get them in a way that would look nice and pretty and checked and rechecked. And I mean, we were dealing with lots of numbers, and we just didn't have enough time to put it all together. Okay. We will have it to you later this week.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, what do we want to do here?
This is Paula. Jim, you might say what the projected 2013 per employee rate that an employer would pay now without the increase and the deductions and not without the change in the percentage and what it would be with as in the bill. Did that make sense?
Okay,
or less.
I'll give it a try.
If by 2013, if we made no changes, right, what the tax rate would be, and after this bill would go into effect, what that rate would be at 2013 for the employer.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. I noted earlier that under the proposal, that by 2013, the full cost of the benefit increase would be in effect in the financing system. And we estimated that the average per worker cost to employers would be $548. I ran a number on what would be the result if we factored in a change in the tax share going from 80-20 to 73-27. And that new number would go down to $498.
Okay. Good to know.
And the employee portion, let's see, with the WBA increase by 2013 alone, we estimated that they would pay $157, which is essentially what they're paying currently in 2008, and that would go up to $197. And these numbers are before factoring in the $800,000 change from taking the minimum qualifying amount of wages up from $1,000 to $2,500. And I think I figured it would be about a $5 further decline in cost for employers. So I'm not sure for the employee side if it maybe it amount to a dollar. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Questions or comments from Mr. Wilson? If not, Paula, I want to ask you to do a commercial, if you would, for the confidentiality provisions in this legislation. That came up at the work session, how important those sections are to you to comply with federal law. And some of the my members here weren't privy to that because it was a work session. So if you could just briefly tell us how important it is that this bill pass.
I'll do a 30-second Super Bowl commercial. Okay. Sections 1 through 8 of this bill, the state of Alaska has to come in compliant with federal law. If we don't, we get millions of dollars. We get sanctioned by the U.S. Department of Labor. It's because of a change in federal law. So it's just conformity. As you, we all see many, many years, I think I was before you last year with some conformity legislation or the year before and something else. It's just conformity legislation to federal law.
Okay. Appreciate that. And that didn't cost you what a Super Bowl ad would usually cost. Is there anyone else from the Department of Labor who has any comments on these the new CS that would be helpful to us?
I'm not sure where you want to go.
Only if questions arise.
We have people here for all kinds of questions.
Right. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The issue of those fired from misconduct, and I realize that that was a $5.4 million savings, and the decision was made that that you may wind up with more people fired for misconduct, and it would just skewer things. But is there something you're trying to accomplish here with denying benefit for people with fired for misconduct? Is there something that is happening on a national level to try to address those people that are fired for misconduct? And maybe you should tell me what that is. I assume it's maybe drunk on the job or using drugs and that person is fired. But what we're saying is now these people will still get the benefits.
I'm going to have Bill Kramer, because they don't automatically get benefits a week later as it is. So I'm going to bring Bill Kramer up to talk about that.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Sense. Yeah, I know I can hear the point you're going for. Mr. Kramer, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bill Kramer. I'm the Chief of Unemployment Insurance for the Department of Labor.
I might say what existing law. Would you like to know what existing law is now, first?
What is asking about? Do other states successfully address the issue of denying benefits to people who have been fired for misconduct? I realize we're saying we're going to give up on that because it could be abused, and let's not even go there. But still in all, isn't there a very good reason to fire people who have been guilty of misconduct and not give them benefits? Isn't there a good reason to do that? And is there something else we know other than just abandoning the whole issue and say we give up? It's too complex.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, one of the fundamental principles of the program is to pay benefits to workers who are unemployed through no fault of their own. And so when we talk about discharge for misconduct in connection with the work, generally we accept that those people are unemployed through their own fault, through their own actions. The current law puts the responsibility on the employer to show that there was actually misconduct in connection with the work, and the law and the regulation are pretty clear on that. simple incompetence on the job does not rise to misconduct, and a worker would not be denied benefits for being incapable of performing the job. The examples you cited are correct. Things like that, typically we have to show that the employer has to show that the worker was, there was a policy explained to the worker, the worker understood the policy, it may have been drinking or drugs or treating customers rudely, driving business away. It has to be something that rises to a fairly severe level. As far as the nation goes, I probably have the exact number here, but it's I think it's 45 or 46 of the other states that disqualify benefits indefinitely if someone is discharged for misconduct in connection with the work. And so the person is typically denied, they say, and we say indefinitely, or until the worker goes back into the workforce and earns some significant amount of wages and then perhaps gets laid off again in the future. So there's a requalifying provision. There must be in any provision. Our current statute denies a person if we find that they are discharged for misconduct in connection with the work. They're discharged for, they're denied benefits for 6 weeks from the date of the discharge. Their benefits are reduced by 3 times their weekly benefit amount, and they are ineligible for any federal extensions that may be available. So that's the current provision. Does that help?
Well, I think so. And Mr. Chairman, I mean, I know that this is a very touchy business, and you move here and you have to move there, and you're constantly trying to figure out what the best thing to do is. But what, in fact, we've done is to say we're not going to deal with people who are fired for misconduct, and that's going to cost us $5.4 million. We are going to deal with the 1,460 people that earn between $1,000 and $2,500 and deny them benefits. So I'm thinking, you know, that's, we're saving $0.8 million by denying those people benefits. We're losing $5.4 million by giving benefits to people who've been fired for misconduct. I mean, it's a strange business we're in, I understand, and I don't know the right answer, but I'm not sure if we're doing what we want to be doing here. Is this where the state wants to take us, the department, in dealing with employees? Do we really want to provide benefits for people fired for misconduct?
For the record, Senator Stevens, we didn't draft up this bill.
Well, someone's at fault.
And we got this version of the bill at 111 today. Mm-hmm. And the last version we saw a disqual. So it's not the department. The only section, I mean, we've been asked questions, but that, you know.
No, I understand. But tell us why we shouldn't do this then. Tell us why we should not take out the misconduct issue, if you believe that.
Senator Stevens, the department is neutral on this bill except for the first 9 sections. First 8 sections of what we have to have. The rest is up to policy decisions made by the legislature. I previous to the 5 years I worked at Department of Labor, I worked on the third floor in the Lieutenant Governor's office, and I actually found notes on when I was working in that office on UI, and I found I worked for legislative research for 12 years, and I worked on unemployment insurance. So the whole thing is give and take, and you know, it's all policy decisions that the legislature has to make.
Thank you, Ms. Guevara.
Thank you.
I hear you. Politics is the art of the possible, and or in terms of public policy, certainly. And we put out proposals. We've tried to find balances in the money and in the policy. And, you know, there was one proposal on the table, and that seemed to be a brick wall to move forward. So I adjusted the percentages for the money and trying to help the employers in that way. But it just seemed like it was a hurdle we couldn't get over. In some sort of timely manner to get this bill flowing through. If someone has some sort of reasonable compromise or thoughts about that, I think we're interested in that somewhere in the process. But I'm just trying to solve problems and move the bill along. But we definitely will have the discussion.
Mr. Chairman. And
Senator Davis.
I understand what Senator Stevens is saying, but we could bring that particular issue back at any time we want to as policymakers. And I understand where you're coming from, that you were not able to come to any real agreement and you thought it would hold the bill up, and there are things that need to go forward within the 90-day session that we have. Mm-hmm. But we should be mindful that we can bring this back at any time through the committee process or any individual that might want to. And I'm appreciative that we do have some of the things in the bill that we do have, and I wouldn't like to hold this bill up any further. But I also understand where Senator Stevens is coming from, and I think we should not drop the ball in that and really pick that up and look at it during the interim when we're out of session.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Senator Davis. I'd hate to see the whole thing stymied on that, though it is a related issue. Committee staff just passed me a note that says, just to remind us, that the committee substitute, this one, would make no change to current law respecting discharge for misconduct. We currently deny, so it's the status quo. We currently deny benefits for 6 weeks for misconduct discharge. So it's sort of the status quo in this new committee substitute. Mr. Vince Beltrami has signed up to testify. I'm going to ask if there's other, if you guys would shift over. We'll take Mr. Beltrami's testimony, and then we'll see if there are other folks here in the committee room who would like to give public testimony on the CS. Mr. Beltrami? Okay. Vince, are you there?
I am, Senator.
Please go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. I actually hadn't signed up to testify in this one, but I'd certainly, I did on HGR 25, but I know there's been a lot of discussion, and I'd certainly weigh in a little bit. You know, I do appreciate the struggles that you guys are engaged in to try to move the legislation out. It's been way too long since I think Alaska's employees have had an increase to their unemployment benefit, and I see some of the compromises you're having to settle for, and I'm not happy with some of them, as I think you know. I don't like to see anything that's more punitive to the employees, and I think there is some punitive stuff there in light of the fact that the employers have gotten such a break on their taxes at this point, and this has given them even further breaks. But at this time, the way the CS is drafted, seeing that I don't think we can do much better at this point, I would encourage you to pass this out of Labor and Commerce as is drafted. And thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, Mr. Beltrami, thanks for your testimony. Representative Crawford was raising his hand. And Wayne Stevens from the state chamber will follow him. Representative Crawford, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to speak to the issue about being fired for cause. Everything that we do here has consequences. Some of them are unintended consequences. But it's a fairly severe penalty right now to, I mean, if you're fired for cause, and some, I mean, it's in dispute, you know, sometime who's at fault when you're being fired. I myself have been fired a number of times, twice in one day, for my union organizing activities. And like I said, I actually got back wages, but that was 2 or 3 years down the road. It takes a long time to go through that process. But what I don't want to do by the provision that we were talking about, where you couldn't get unemployment benefits at all if you got fired for cause, you're giving an incentive out there to fire people rather than lay them off when the work season or the job is about done. I believe that what's happened, in fact, in other states when they've brought this penalty to bear, is that many more people are fired. And I think that 6 weeks is a pretty severe penalty as it is, and I don't want to see us go to a longer penalty and give an unscrupulous employer that incentive to fire people. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Harry. Appreciate your testimony.
If you want any questions.
Nope. Doesn't look like it.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Stevens, come on up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, I'm Wayne Stevens, President and CEO of the Alaska State Chamber. We've only had the benefit of the last hour or so to review this bill, and we were very supportive of last week's efforts and appreciate the hard work that you have put forth, you and your staff, on trying to reach compromise. Certainly no one in the business community would disagree with the need to increase the benefit. We would point out, for the benefit of those who haven't participated in the past, that while the rates have virtually stayed the same, the taxable amounts have increased every single year. And since 1996, the taxable amount to the employer and employee has gone from $24,400 to this year, $31,300. So it's not unlike the property tax, where the tax rate stays the same, but the assessment continues to increase each year. So the cost to business has increased annually without benefit of increase to the employee in the benefit. We are certainly at this moment in a period of low unemployment across the nation, across the state, and as a result, the contributions to the trust fund have risen, and the drawdown on that has decreased. So, I mean, there's no shifting of burden at this point from employer to employee, and there's no benefit accruing to employers other than the draw on the fund is reduced at this moment. So this notion that perhaps employers are getting an unfair advantage perhaps is incorrect. You know, we certainly support your efforts to try to make these changes. Again, without benefit of the financial work that we had in front of us last week, we're a little behind the power curve on trying to say whether we are thumbs up or thumbs down on it, but generally appreciate the efforts that you're making, understand the need to make the change, and if we can, again, as we've stated, make the bill revenue neutral, then we encourage you to move forward.
Mr. Stevens, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time, sir.
We've been going at this for about an hour and a half. I'm going to consider taking a break here for just a few minutes and coming back. We do have this committee substitute before us. I would like to adopt the committee substitute so that we can send this out to folks so people will know officially what the committee is working from. Senator Stevens?
Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for Senate Bill number 120 /L for discussion purposes.
Okay. Is there any discussion of the motion? Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, the Wayne /L version of the bill is the version of the bill before us. Let's take a 5-minute break and come back, and we'll take it from there. I think we probably needed it. I'd like to welcome Representative Kurt Olson, our counterpart and the chair of our counterpart committee in the State House. Welcome. Mr. DeWitt, would you like to come forward and give testimony on Senate Bill 120?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Denny DeWitt, State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. Like was testified by the State Chamber, we do appreciate how you're trying to work this through. Last week we had quite a good discussion, I thought, on the philosophical issue of employees being charged. And as we discussed, NFIB has nationally not been supportive of that. And this moves more in that direction and away from eliminating benefits for workers discharged for cause. We are looking for something that can get as close to cost neutral as possible. We appreciate that greatly. We're going to try and look at this and get back with a little more coherent response. We generally appreciate the way that you're going, and I'll be working with my leadership council to try and get specifics on the posturing. We also appreciate very much addressing the issue of the $1,000 benefit or income earning up to $2,500. So I appreciate your working on this. We do understand and appreciate the fact that there are an awful lot of pressures on various sides to move this forward.
Mr. DeWitt, thank you. Appreciate you being involved in the process. Haven't agreed with all of your ideas, but you've made me, a better advocate or a better committee chair for having listened to your point of view. So thank you.
But you're coming along and we'll continue to work.
Just like the bill, a work in progress. Is there anyone else to testify on the bill today? Because we are moving toward a decision point to move the bill along to the Finance Committee, there are fiscal notes that will need to be updated from our friends at Department of Labor, but we've talked about the fiscal impact today of these changes in the bill. There are charts that we had at the work session that are very favorable, or very impressive, easy to follow, very informative, and those are going to be adjusted to show the greater benefit to employers that we've are proposing or that we've adopted here in this committee substitute. So once again, is there anyone else to testify on the UI bill? The bill goes on to the Senate Finance Committee. At this time, the chair will entertain a motion to move the bill on to the next committee of referral.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion that we move CS for Senate Bill number 120, which is slash L, out of the committee with individual recommendations and the accomplished fiscal notes.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Davis. Is there discussion of the motion? Senator Stevens.
Just to discuss it, I'm not going to object to it moving on to finances where it should be. We're under the gun with a 90-day session, and it's reasonable that it goes there. But I am going to recommend that it be amended. I think there's some issues in the bill that I appreciate all the effort that's gone into it and all the compromise that's been reached. But I'm still concerned about the people being fired for misconduct. I don't know that we should take that out entirely. Maybe something should be there. I'm still concerned about the additional 1,400 people that are being denied benefits between $1,000 and $2,500. So those are issues I'm still concerned about. And I say I'm not going to oppose moving it forward.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate your sensitivity to the work that's been done and the work yet to do and the time frame available to do it. So is there any further discussion of the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, the bill moves on to the next committee referral with individual recommendations and updated and accompanying fiscal notes. That's the end of our work today. Again, thank you to the business folks, the Department of Labor, all interested parties. We appreciate you being with us today. The committee will be back at it on Tuesday at our regular time. If there's no further business to come before us, Dana, is there anything else? If not, we are adjourned at 3:10 in the afternoon. Thank you all very much.